Matthew chapter 24. As we begin a study tonight, I want to remind you that this is a same account recorded by Luke in Luke chapter 21 and Mark's account in Mark 13. Remember also, there's a section in Luke 17 that deals with the destruction of Jerusalem. And if you have not been looking at those accounts together with this, you'd be very surprised what we can learn by looking at those accounts in connection with Matthew's account given here. We ended at verse 13 last Wednesday evening. I want to pick up reading at verse 3 and read very quickly down simply for the sake of context through verse 13. Verse 3 of Matthew 24 and reading in the New King James Version. "And as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all of these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in various places. All of these things are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. You'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end will be saved.'" And now verse 14, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." Remember the questions that was asked back in chapter 24 and in verse 3. Seems as though Matthew asked three questions, but as we notice Luke's account and Mark's account, it is simply two questions that's being asked. When will these things be? And what will be the sign of the end of these things? Because the end of these things is the end of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. He had just mentioned that. Not one stone will be left upon another. That would be the end of the temple, the end of the city of Jerusalem. Of course, the end of the nation of Israel, as judgment is being brought against them on this occasion. In verse 14, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." So the gospel of the kingdom will be preached before the end comes to all nations. Note that. Will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. What was the great giving of the Great Commission? Well, it was to go and to preach the gospel of the kingdom to all nations, Jew and Gentile. Well, before Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, had the gospel gone to all nations, Jew and Gentile? We have to say, yes, it had gone to all nations, Jew and Gentile. Doesn't mean that it had to go all around the world before the end comes, because the end under consideration is still that end which started out at the beginning of the chapter. The end of the city of Jerusalem, the end of the temple, when one stone will not be left upon another. Not only that, we see later on down in the context that this generation will not pass away until all of these things are fulfilled. So if that generation will not pass away before the end comes, can't be the coming of Christ in his second coming. If that be the case, then that generation is gone, but yet Christ has not come in his second coming yet. So the coming under consideration, of course, is the coming in judgment upon the city of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. But I wanted to note just a passage with you in Colossians 1, Colossians chapter 1, verse 6, and note what Paul says. Colossians 1 and in verse 6, pick up at verse 5. Because of the hope which is laid up for you in heaven, of which you heard before, and the word of the truth of the gospel, which has come to you, as it has also in all the world, and is bringing forth fruit, as it is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God in truth. And then jumping it out in the context of verse 23, if indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel, which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. You see, back in our text under consideration, when it speaks of the world, and verse 14 of Matthew 24, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Sometimes the word world simply has reference to all the Roman Empire. All the Roman Empire, the known world at that time. That's what's under consideration. It's used like that in several different places. For example, in Acts chapter 11 and in verse 28. Acts 11 and verse 28, then one of them, named Agabus, stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar, throughout all the world, throughout all the Roman Empire. That's the idea expressed there. Acts 17 and in verse 6 we see the world used again in the sense of the Roman Empire. Acts 17 and in verse 6, but when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, these who have turned the world upside down have come here too. Well, Paul and them hadn't been everywhere in the world. They'd been throughout the Roman Empire. And that's the way it is used there and other places in the New Testament. We'd go on and look at some other places, but I think you get the point. So it's not that the gospel of the kingdom was going to be preached in every place in the world before the end come, but it's going to be preached throughout the Roman Empire to all nations. That is to both Jew and Gentile. Paul said it had happened in Colossians 1, verse 6 and 23, read a few moments ago. And then the end will come. So if the gospel has been preached in all the world, all the Roman Empire, to both Jew and Gentile, then the end will come. Not the end of the world, but the end of the Jewish nation, the end to the city of Jerusalem and the temple. That's what's under consideration. Just a little bit in regard to this idea of coming here. Coming. We're going to see it expressed again in verse 30 of chapter 24. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth, or literally land, will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, there's other things we want to discuss in that verse, but I want us to look at this idea of coming. Some people think, well, Christ can't come unless he physically comes. Well, no, Christ can come and be present without his physical presence. Without his physical presence. Notice, if you will, with me in Matthew 16, and in verse 28. In Matthew 16 and in verse 28, and we could go to Mark 9 and verse 1 and read the same thing. Assuredly, I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death, note this, till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. To see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom? So there would be some standing there with him right now who will not taste death, that is, they'll not experience death, till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, you've been in the church for a great number of years, most of you. What do we normally point that toward? When did Christ come in his kingdom? That he promised the apostles that there'd be some of you standing here who would not taste death. Till you see Christ coming in his kingdom. Either that kingdom and that coming was on the day of Pentecost, or it's coming in judgment on the city of Jerusalem. Because those people have long died. It was part of that generation. He said, you'll not taste death, you'll not experience death till you see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Well, did they see Him physically? No. But on the day of Pentecost, who was it that Peter preached? He preached Jesus Christ. Christ came on the day of Pentecost and established the church. Did He come physically? No. He did not come physically. But nonetheless, He came. He came, or either that generation is still alive, and we know that is not the case. Also, in Matthew 10, and we noted this in our study earlier, Matthew 10, I want to look at verse 22 with you. Matthew 10 and verse 22. And you will be hated by all for My name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. Does that sound familiar? Sounds like what we just read in Matthew 24 and in verse 13. He who endures to the end will be saved. The end of what? Well, the end of the nation of Israel. The destruction of Jerusalem, as Matthew 24 and verse 13 points to that. In Matthew 24 and in verse 30, we see His coming. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Not the Son of Man, but the sign of the Son of Man will appear. Now, were they going to be able to see the Son of Man? No. But they'd see the sign of the Son of Man. What was the sign of the Son of Man coming? Well, it was the destruction of Jerusalem. That's what the sign was. As a matter of fact, in Matthew 26, note this, as He is defending Himself on trial before His crucifixion, Matthew 26 and in verse 64. Matthew 26 and in verse 64, we've noted this before as well. Matthew 26 and verse 64, and Jesus said to him, speaking to the high priest on this occasion, nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, was he literally going to see it? No, he was going to see it in the destruction of Jerusalem. Was Jesus literally going to be riding on the clouds? And we'll talk about that later. It's just simply Old Testament language. Speaks about God coming in the clouds in regard to judgment, showing His strength and His power when He brings about an end to a nation. And we'll look at some Old Testament passages in connection with Matthew 24 and in verse 30 later on in regard to that coming in the clouds. But to the high priest, he said, you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Well, he wasn't literally going to see that, but he was going to see that take place in the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem. Back to our text now, Matthew 24 and in verse 15. Matthew 24 and in verse 15, picking up, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to his clothes. After giving them some general things that were going to take place, such as wars and rumors of wars and famines and pestilence and earthquakes in various places, now he really gives them a sign of the time in which the end is going to come. They would be able to see this. Not only that, they would be able to take their scrolls of Daniel and read where Daniel spoke about the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. This phrase, abomination of desolation, is simply the abomination that makes desolate. The abomination that makes desolate. We might not know specifically what's under consideration by the abomination that makes desolate, but evidently when we read Luke's account, Luke 21 and verse 20, he simply refers to it as the Roman army. Luke 21, remember, Luke's account in Luke 21 and in verse 20. Luke 21 and in verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Know that its desolation is near, so the abomination of desolation is the abomination that brings about desolation. And so what's going to bring about that desolation? Well, it's going to be the Roman armies that do that. But Daniel wrote about the abomination of desolation. I want us to go back to Daniel. Now, we looked at some of this already, but just in case you were not here, let's just read a couple of passages in Daniel. Let's look at Daniel 12 and verse 11. Daniel 12 and verse 11. Let's pick up at verse 10. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now when you look, go all the way back to the beginning of Daniel 12, you see the prophecy is concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. We've read through that, some of it before. This abomination of desolation is also spoken of in chapter 11 and verse 31. Chapter 11 and verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. We could go back to chapter 9, verse 26 and 27 and read it as well. So the people of this day, as they would go back and they read the scroll of the prophet Daniel, the only thing they could conclude, and the only thing we can conclude, is that Jesus gives a divine interpretation to what Daniel was writing about. Luke 21 and verse 20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near. Then here, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So when you see the Roman armies surround the city of Jerusalem, you know that its desolation is near. You know that it's time almost for the city to be destroyed. But then it says in verse 16, before we consider other things in verse 15, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. One would suppose that, well, by the time you see Jerusalem surrounded by the Roman armies, it's too late to flee. They've got you surrounded. So how is it that you can flee? We'll talk about that in just a moment. But back to verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, the holy place. Now we could go and we could look in various places and note that the temple is referred to as a holy place, Acts 21 and verse 28. And we could also see that the city of Jerusalem is referred to as the holy city. So the holy place, could it be the temple, or could it be the city and the temple as a whole? Either way, it really doesn't matter. The abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. No doubt the Roman armies are in the city of Jerusalem. They've surrounded the city of Jerusalem. And of course they will be in the holy place and in the temple before it's over with, as they'll burn and destroy it. So it doesn't matter whether the holy place is the temple or whether it's the city, because both are referred to as a holy place. So how is it that they would be able to flee? Well, I mentioned last Wednesday evening about an individual by the name of Sestus Gallus. He was a Roman procurator from Syria, or Roman governor. And remember I said that he had led a force of Roman soldiers against the city of Jerusalem on one occasion to put down the uprisings of the Jews back in 66 A.D. And in fact, he did. And he laid siege to the city of Jerusalem for 1 week. And he could have destroyed the city had he wanted to, perhaps on that occasion. But for some unknown reason, Josephus tells us, Josephus didn't even know, he lifted the siege and headed back to Syria. And remember I said last week that the Jews gathered themselves together and went after them and destroyed a large force of those Romans on that occasion. That precipitated, you might say, the beginning point of the Roman and Jewish wars. Because Nero was in Greece during this particular period of time, and he hears about this. And after that, then he sends Vespasian to put down the uprising of the Jews. So on this occasion, in verse 16, the Christians had an opportunity to flee the city. When they saw Jerusalem surrounded by armies, the siege is all of a sudden lifted. Everybody has an opportunity to flee that wants to flee. Note what he said at the end of verse 15. Whoever reads, let him understand. Whoever reads, let him understand. When you go back in Daniel and read about the abomination of desolation, whoever reads it, let him understand. Let him understand that I'm making application to that here. Remember we read in the book of Daniel about the final and complete end of the nation? Daniel was told to seal up the book until the final or complete end. Well, the final or complete end has come. It's time for it. So then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Josephus tells us that Christians fled during this time period. And they fled to the eastern side of the Jordan River, to Perea. Most of them went to a city called Pella in that region. But of course, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. When you flee to the mountains, you have places to hide in the rocks and the crevices and the caves. You can flee from the enemy. And let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Why? Because during this particular period of time, you need to exercise great haste. Great haste, because the end is coming. And if you don't take this opportunity when the Romans are not there, you're going to lose an opportunity to save your life. So let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Don't collect up your belongings. Why would someone be on the housetop? Well, houses in that part of the country during this particular period of time were flat. They spent a great deal of time on their rooftops. Sometimes they would even sleep on the rooftops when it was very hot and it was cooler and a breeze blowing. And so let him who is on the housetop not even go down to take anything out of his house. How would he get off the rooftop? Well, usually they had a stairway leading from the rooftop down the side of the house on the outside. That way they wouldn't have to go back into the house. The point under consideration is he's not literally saying don't take something like food or clothing with you. The point under consideration is you make haste. Don't try to collect a lot of belongings and take off with them, because collecting those belongings are going to slow you down. You need to preserve your life. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. They would leave the city of Jerusalem and their houses in the city of Jerusalem, go outside the gates of the city and work in the fields. Well, there needs to be haste exercised to get away from the enemy. Don't even take time to go back into the city to get your clothes. You need to get away as quickly as you possibly can. Verse 19, but woe to those who are pregnant. Woe. Sometimes that word, that interjection, is a denunciation. We saw that earlier in chapter 23. But here it has reference to the sad condition that would come upon those who were pregnant and nursing children at this particular period of time. I want you to think about trying to escape from an enemy and you're pregnant, or you have nursing babies, you're trying to carry them along with you. It would be bad enough because it's a time of great war and great destruction and chaos and anarchy. But to have children and dragging them along with you, especially if they're at nursing age, and especially if you were pregnant, it would just make things that much more difficult. I think we have an allusion to this particular point in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 26. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 26. In that context, Paul is speaking about marriage. And whether it's all right for a man to give his virgin daughter in marriage or not. And he mentions the time. I forget exactly the phrase that was used, so I'll have to look it up myself. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 26. Now, 1 Corinthians, remember, was written by Paul perhaps late in 57 A.D. That's a good while before the Roman and Jewish wars take place. But 1 Corinthians 7, and in verse 26 he says, let's just pick up at verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose therefore that this is good, note this, because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. In the context, unmarried. Why? Because of the present distress. Because of what's coming in the future. Who would want to take a wife and bring children into the world when there's going to be war taking place in your land? Would you want your wife to be pregnant at that time? Would you want her to be nursing babies at that time? Absolutely not. So because of the present distress, perhaps Paul thought it was just best for a man to remain unmarried and a virgin daughter to remain unmarried at that particular period of time. But remember, in that context, Paul said, but if they can't control themselves, they need to go ahead and marry. So he wasn't forbidding them to marry. He was just giving his judgment in regard to the matter. And the same thing might be true for us today. If you were going off to war, would you jump up and marry a woman? Produce a child with her before you left? It wouldn't be reasonable to do that because you may be leaving a widow. It just wouldn't be reasonable and prudent to do that. And so I think that in this connection, I think that's connected here in some way with that thought. In verse 20 again, and pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. Why in the winter? Because in the winter the rains come. It would make it more difficult to travel. It make it more difficult to flee. The weather conditions would make it more difficult. It's the reason we don't fight a lot of wars in the winter. We try not to, because it is a lot more difficult. Or on the Sabbath. Why? Because on the Sabbath, the Orthodox Jews would lock the gates of the city. You couldn't get out. Why? Because they thought you would perhaps travel more than a Sabbath day's journey. You'd be in violation of the law of Moses, they said. So that's why, pray that it not be on the Sabbath. Verse 21, for then there will be great tribulation. And note that word then. Then. We've seen that several times. We started seeing it in verse 9, and we're going to continue to see it. Then something else takes place. Then at this time, then at this time. So here we have, after what was mentioned in verse 15, the Roman army surrounded the city for 1 week under Cestius Gallus, but they didn't stay. They left for some unknown reason, give people opportunity to flee. But then, for then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. Great tribulation. I want to go back to Daniel 12 and verse 1. Daniel 12 and verse 1. I just want you to see how this connects. Daniel 12 and verse 1. We read it earlier as we introduced our study of this. But Daniel 12 and verse 1. At that time Micah shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Note this now. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. Does that sound familiar? Sounds awful lot like what we just read there in Matthew 24 and in verse 21. Matthew 24 and in verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. There will be great tribulation. There will be great tribulation. It's referred to often by the premillennialists as the great tribulation period. Of course, they don't associate it with the years of the Roman and Jewish wars. They associate it with their premillennial doctrine and teaching. But the great tribulation period covered the period of time from the Roman and Jewish wars. Perhaps from the time that Vespasian came back with the Roman force of 60,000 soldiers in the Galilean campaign. And that's where Josephus, as I mentioned, the Jewish historian, was defeated. Not only did he come from a priestly family, but he was a general that led the Jewish forces in the fight against Vespasian. And remember, Vespasian just simply decimated them. 60,000 trained Roman soldiers against Jews who really weren't trained to fight in war. So he just simply decimated them in the Galilean campaign. That was in the fall of 67 AD. And then Josephus becomes an interpreter for him, a translator for him, and is present at the destruction of Jerusalem. But the Roman and Jewish wars, perhaps we would say they started, you might say, then, and then culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, 3.5 years. This is the Great Tribulation period. The Great Tribulation period. Now think about what's going to be taking place during the Roman and Jewish wars. A lot of people are going to lose their life throughout the land. All of those Jews that fought against Vespasian in the Galilean campaign, thousands were killed. A lot of them were taken into slavery, into captivity. And it would continue as he moved closer and closer to the city of Jerusalem. Also want to note something else in regard to this great tribulation. Look with me in Revelation 7. Revelation 7 and verse 14. I believe John makes reference to this particular period of time. If it is not the great tribulation that Daniel wrote about and Jesus spoke of it, then what great tribulation period is it? As a matter of fact, Jesus said again, for then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. That's kind of absolute. That means there will never be another great tribulation period like this great tribulation period. Revelation 7 and verse 14. Revelation 7 and verse 14. We'll pick up, let's just pick up at verse 11. And all the angels stood around the throne, and the elders and the four living creatures, and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, Who are these? Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? And I said to them, Sir, you know. So he said to me, These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They came out of the great tribulation. Is there another great tribulation period? Jesus said there will never be another one like this one. Has to be the same one. Has to be the same one that Daniel wrote about as well, because they're writing about the exact same thing. Verse 22. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. For the elect's sake? Who are the elect? Well, of course, the premillennialist says it's the Jews. But we know the elect are the chosen ones of God. Christians, that's who's under consideration. For the Christians' sake, for the sake of Christians, the great tribulation period was shortened. Could have gone on and on. But for the sake of Christians, it was shortened. 3.5 years. That was long enough. As a matter of fact, actually they didn't finish the Roman and Jewish wars. Masada didn't fall till about 75 A.D. But nonetheless, you might say it was over with in 70 A.D. when Israel, the nation itself, was destroyed. The city was laid waste along with the temple. We're out of time. Questions or comments at this time? Note verse 23, just a couple of minutes. Then, there's that word again, then if anyone says to you, then, at that time, during the great tribulation period, during those 3.5 years, because the end hasn't come yet. See verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds. That's when the end comes. Then, verse 23, during the great tribulation period, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, and note that the Christ, literally the Messiah. Look, here is the Messiah, or there, do not believe it. Now, didn't he start out with that very thing? Jumping back into context, chapter 24, and in verse 4, and Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, I am the Messiah, and deceive many. So during this great tribulation period, during the time of the Roman and Jewish wars, if someone says to you, look, here is the Christ. Now, why would they say that? Because he's promised his coming. But Jesus, again, is trying to get them to understand, I'm not physically coming. I've already come. And there would be false Christ. So look, here is the Christ there. Do not believe it. Do not believe it. You're not going to see me physically coming. Verse 24, for false Christ and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Now we're studying in 1 John, and I associated the Antichrist with the false prophets, false teachers, those who deceive. Remember, John said it was the last hour. Who were they deceiving? The elect. Christians. Saying that this Jesus of Nazareth, he was a nobody. His father was a carpenter. He didn't come from a royal family. How could he be the Christ? How could he be the Messiah? And so they would proclaim others as the Messiah. They would deceive. We'll pick up here next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention this evening.